So let's start today's lecture in virtual machines. Last time we've had a major part concerning the function declarations, the function call from the perspective of the caller and the callee. And particularly this was more interesting than the one from the SEMA, since there's this behavior of under and oversupply that we had to somehow take care of. So with that now already in the bag, we can switch over to the last topics in the functional languages. And a thing that we haven't covered so far is has been closures and their evaluation. So let's have a look at them once again, or well, more detailed than before. So you have seen the use of closures a lot during the implementation of CBN code generation schemes, particularly at the cases where we had to bind names via let and let rec expressions, also for actual parameters of functions. So this was quite in handy to somehow lazily evaluate expressions only. However, at some point you can't evade actually really executing and evaluating these expressions anymore. At the point where the variable is finally actually really accessed, the value needs to be available for this thing. And we have introduced already in our code generation scheme the instruction eval for that, but we haven't really talked about what that really does. So eval is, well, in that sense, a little bit like a mini function call in that sense. So these closures, as you might remember, were intended to act as pointers to code at some point and carried with them bindings to the global variables used within the closures. So this is quite similar to what the definition of a function would already do. So it's just logical that eval is pretty similar to what the function application would look like. So let's have a look at how this works. So same as the application of a function, you would construct a new stack frame to somehow manage how to return to your originating call site, and then switch over to a new part in the code. So the eval would be called, and it is always called with a pointer, a reference to some heap object on top of the stack, which would have to be ensured to be evaluated. And this is done by, first of all, checking whether the heap object found reference from the top of the stack is actually one of the kind closure or something else. So if there's something else, then this cannot be further evaluated and is already useful as a value to use later on. But if there's still a closure at that point, we still need to evaluate the according expression. And this is treated in the body of this branch. And it follows a similar route as the function call. So first of all, there's this idea of allocating a stack frame. Then we make sure that the reference to the closure is actually found on top of the stack before we then finally do the application. And if you look at that sequence, the only thing that is kind of missing in that sense is the part where you evaluate the parameters of a function. If you do away with them, then you come to this kind of sequence here. So this is a special purpose implementation of what a function call would look like just for closures. So closures in that sense you could also interpret as just a parameterless function. So, yeah, it just remains to see now how these special purpose instructions look like, and there's the implementation for that. So there's the mark that would serve for installing the management cells on the push down. So this part is created, that is there for keeping references to the old management structures, like the old global pointer or the old frame pointer, as well as the old PC. Well, this remains the same here, so you can also highlight it here, but the old PC is also put in there. So these are the three top stack cells after the execution of the mark. Then in our sequence, we had an instruction that we already knew, which is this push log, which would then serve for, well, extracting whatever is found in there and put it on top of the push down. In our context, this would mean that usually you would find the reference to the closure at that spot in the push down, since this has been found on top before. And this just goes to the top of the stack then in order to give us something to execute the apply on. And this is the point where the apply then is used. So this is a pointer to a closure that we see here. And the apply then does, well, we find that the closure carries with itself an address of the actual code to execute. So this has to go in the program counter. And the other thing is that the closure carries a reference to a global pointer as the for an environment for the global variables. So this has also needs to be installed in the machine, and this is done by copying that into the global pointer register. So, as a sequence in an animation, if you execute an eval starting from closure on top of the push down, see, you get this, this structure of a closure with a code pointer and a global pointer. The mark would at first install a stack frame to ensure that we continue afterwards with our original point in the program. It would duplicate, or well, not duplicate, but extract the reference to the closure from somewhere down in the pushdown stack, and then the apply would start to actually really modify our program counter and global pointer in order to execute whatever the closure has done. So this is kind of a poor man's function called in one sense without any actual parameters, and thus no hassle with things like oversupply or undersupply. So there's a whole lot of things that we don't really have to take into account, like this TRG and all that. So, the other side, let's have a look at how we can then construct such a closure for an expression. So, well, the only thing that you really have to make sure of is that there, if there is references to global variables, you need to make sure that you somehow bind some expressions to those. So first of all, you will probably start by looking at the free variables of said expression and extract them. And for those, you will generate these getvar macro things that will create the according expressions on the pushdown and bind them in the address environment to the respective slot that they go into. Then you will collect them into a vector, and out of the vector you will then create the closure data structure. So there's no parameters involved, so you can directly continue with make closure, and you give it also the code pointer where the actual closure code is generated into. This is given by this label A. And the only thing that is kind of somewhat newish here is this update instruction that follows the code body of the closure. Yeah. Apart from that, all that remains is just jumping to the end of everything in order to continue with regular expression evaluation. So what do we have to look at? Well, first of all, there's an example of how something like this can look like. So there's the usual thing, which is this one over here, for which we would like the code for a closure. So this has a free variable A, which we find to be local with index 0 at the stack distance 1, which will let us to create push lock 1 for that. This goes into a vector that goes into the closure, and the closure itself would start at A. And if you and after creating the closure, we will just jump to the end of everything. So now what is the closure itself? The closure itself consists in the evaluation of the multiplication, which is this thing on those two operands, followed by a make basic to pack it onto the heap, followed by now our newly introduced update thing. What might this thing actually do? Well, you have this concept here that closure can be at some point evaluated, and we would like to cache the result of whatever we have done there. So the purpose of this update will be to make the once performed evaluation kind of available for future use. And we do that usually, well, we'll see that a little bit later on, because first of all we need to quickly say what the making process of a closure is. And well, the closure then starts from the global variable vector on the push down and packs that into its place in closure data structure together with the according address where the actual closure code resides. So that is that. The update we wanted to highlight is something that we can express with things that we have already had before. Particularly, this would eliminate the current stack frame and restore the original one. So that's something that we have already seen in this popenv. And with the resulting value, we would then proceed to rewrite what has once been a closure data structure on the heap into an actual value. And same as before for this let rec thing, we need to make sure that the references to this thing will also get the update on that, otherwise we won't have any benefit of evaluating and caching the computed result. So again, it's crucial to make sure that we don't really introduce a reference to somewhere else for this thing, because this won't get transported to every other place where the closure has been referred to. Instead, what we want to do is we want to really edit the piece of memory that was there for the closure and override it with everything that came from in there. So this will get us an update on the former closure, which will then evaluate to whatever the closure has produced. And thus, in future calls of eval, the initial guard, had to be happening at some point. The initial guard here will, next time that we call an eval on the former closure, will not match a closure anymore, but whatever will have been produced by then. If it's a new closure, okay, well then we have to evaluate that, of course. But in principle, we have the chance here to see something else, like a basic value or a function object or whatever you might imagine that can be produced by the closure. So in that case then, we won't try to reevaluate anymore, but then just jump through and continue with whatever comes after eval. So that is the whole purpose of this update thing. Okay, so if don't have any particular question on that anymore, then we are somewhat done with the translation of functional programs, at least with what we perceive as the core of a functional language. We can now continue with doing optimizations and extensions of our core concepts. So there's the scheme of translation that you have seen so far is a somewhat simplistic one that would try to make the everything that happens for a particular software construct treated locally just for this particular instruction. But if you have some what of a more more widened view on the code that you're producing, you might find that you could do things a little bit more optimal without so many instructions, for example, and so many accesses to either the code memory or the data memory. So let's have a look at how such optimizations can make our code more efficient. So what we have maybe not yet the experience with, if we aren't real functional programmers, but if you start doing your own experiments with that, you will notice that you will probably create a lot of F and C objects. Closures and functions are kind of everywhere in functional programming, that's the name. So this will quite often require us to somehow provide global vectors, since these are basic components of the F and C objects, and also kind of make up a lot of the actual instructions that are involved in creating such objects. So, yeah, that is the code for the closure. So you see there's quite a lot of instructions that go into the, as well as this one, that go into the generation of the global pointer. So you might as well wonder if that is a thing that you have to do in the way that we have seen here. And indeed, you can come up with concepts of, for example, reusage of global vectors. Recycling is a big thing now. So where would be potential for reusing global vectors? Well, what we have seen, for example, is the for example, let expressions, where there's a lot of let in in sequence after each other. And you could, for example, instead of generating global vectors for each of these things, you could just merge the free variable sets of all those let definitions and just generate one global vector once and just refer from each of the actual closures then to just that particular global vector, and of course adapt also the variable environments for that in order to make sure that you get the indexing right into each of those or into just this global globally shared global vector. For that, it might come in handy to have a particular instruction that helps you in juggling around the global vectors. This would be the copy glob thing that would serve as a means of extracting the reference to the current global vector from the internal register. So you can somehow reuse that for whatever use you might find for that. Of course, that means that the global vector by itself will possibly contain more components that are actually really ever referred to in your current expression. And the more you progress throughout such a chain of let expression evaluations, for example, you will come to situations where the global vector is pretty long, has a lot of entries, but the remaining expressions to be evaluated just don't make use of a lot of those components anymore. So, well, you see here this term of space leak. I'm not so sure whether leak is the correct word here, because it will, at some point when you have evaluated everything, then you can just free all the references in there. But you keep a lot of the keep a lot of references to data objects around that are not actually in use anymore. So that is maybe more of the appropriate behavior that you see. So what you could do is you could, for example, at the end of the lifetime of a particular global, somehow reset the references in the global vector for those to something not harmful, and in that sense will you would trigger freeing a few of the of these referred expressions. So, yeah, that would be the thing with sharing the global vector. The other thing that is maybe a little bit looks a little bit superfluous is, well, you've seen a lot of places where closures are intended to be created, and they are just created schematically without any intelligence of the context where this template is actually used. So you might also wonder whether the closures are really a good idea to introduce for a lot of the constructs, because if the constructs for which closures are introduced are actually pretty small, then all this make closure generating of a global vector and all that might just be a lot more than the original instruction would have actually been. So executing the code directly and not creating a closure might have been a lot more, a lot cheaper. So this is kind of the motivation for the chapter here, where we think about basic values, variables, and functions, whether you could optimize away things like closures. So in case of basic functions, the direct way of generating code for basic values is, in that sense, well, the maximum that we can create here is, well, just the actual creation of the value on the pushdown, which is usually just one instruction that introduces the constant as top of the stack, and then packing it to in the heap and just leaving the reference down there. If you would go the closure way instead, this one, you would introduce, well, what would you want to do? You would want to create the global vector, which is empty in for our purposes, but we need some stub of a vector at least to put it into the closure object. Then we create this closure object, jump somewhere else to continue, and only then put the code for the generation of the constant in there, and afterwards even perform an update. So there's a lot of kind of noise happening around the actual code, and directly executing the code would probably save us a lot of time. So what the proposition is here then is that we, instead of going to the generic code C version, we would just say, well, for basic values, we will just, instead of creating a closure, we will just delegate to the value object creation, which will then just create one of these buggers here, and we can use them as if a closure that has already been evaluated completely, and yeah, that would be fine. So that is that. Then there's others, like the variable, which is pretty similar to the basic value in that sense. Again, we have the code that is generated for the occurrence of a variable directly, which is pretty short, and well, would have been quite longish if we would just use the general scheme for the closure generation. What would we need to do there? Well, there's an X for which there is no local binding, so this is considered as a global thing. So we put this get var at the beginning and then continue with a lot of noise in that sense, like making a vector out of that, putting that into the closure, and in the closure itself then reading from the vector the value that we've put in, which is just this get var once again, evaluate that, and then do an update of our original memory structure. And this all we can just replace with direct getvar instruction, which will do the same job just in a lot less instructions. So let's have a look at how that proposition of an optimization would work out in practice. So this here is an example of let expression binding values for A and B in expression over here. So if we do that now with our optimized version, what would we obtain? Well, this would be the code that you see here. So this is directly creating the value code versions of the expressions for the let binding instead of putting closures in here, which will give us this nice little thing over here that doesn't have any make closures, doesn't have any make vector things. Instead, it's all nice and easy, just push lock things. So, well, there's even there's a constant, there's even a load C in there, and so we have direct code instead of closures, and this should, in the end, in theory at least, deliver some basic value. So let's have a look at what that does at runtime. So we allocate two slots on the pushdown for the let rec, like this. Then we push again this thing and rewrite to 2. Why do we do that? This was this B is assigned to A, if you remember. So this first loads from the pushdown at position 0 and then rewrites to the cell with distance 2. So this essentially does nothing here. Then we do a load 7. This is the 7 is assigned to B part now. So we load a 7, make a basic value heap object out of that, and use that to rewrite the cell below. So there we bound the basic value of 7 to this guy over here. With that, we are done with the bindings part, and then we go over to the expression in which we bound all these things. And this would now just result in an access to A, which is this C then, and the, on this we would do eval, and doing an eval on such a thing is probably a quite dangerous thing, since we don't have actual code to jump to, which will lead to at some point, well, some address violations, some kind of segmentation fault. So, well, something must have gone awry in our concept of optimizing away closures. So, what was the problem? The thing is, if you think back, here we had the situation that leads to the actual problem. We would do a push lock of 0, which had at that point just our initial closure without any actual real binding on there. You would duplicate that and then use that to store into the cell down there. This was motivated by that part of the expression. And here we can already somehow see why that is. If you just look at the direction in which we evaluate these let expressions, we bound the value for B to the value for A, and both of them are introduced in these let rec expression things. And well, if we do this binding before this binding here, then okay, there's the B has not been bound so far, but has to deliver some kind of value to A, and well, that's probably far from optimal. So what can we do to get rid of something like that? Well, there's a few harmful constructs that will keep us from applying our optimization. For example, what will never really work is this kind of cyclic definitions like the ones over here where you have recursive let bindings of that just form a dependency circle. So A is dependent on B and B is dependent on A. Well, you will never find some kind of meaningful sequence of these instructions that will come up with a good value in this semantics. So cyclic definitions, we should just reject from code generation. Then there's the matter of acyclic definitions. For those, we have seen in the example before that there's still a potential for segmentation faults if they are occurring in a sequence that is suboptimal. So what we should do in that sense is that we should order all the definitions from the let binding such that all the right-hand side variables are defined when this definition is supposed to be translated. So a reordering of the let bindings from here would bind a value to B first, which would then enable this binding to be given to A, and then everything should work fine. So reordering would be the second idea to solve that thing. Okay. So next thing in line is closures for function values. So possible values, of course, can be functions in functional languages, and they usually generate code to create a function frame and generate all the bindings for the global vector and all that. And essentially, if we then apply code C on that, we will again create a closure, and with that a binding for global variables that will then in its code part produce the code that produces the function. So this is kind of an indirection that already looks quite complicated and isn't really actually really contributing much, because in both cases the closure code as well as the function code both act somewhat similar. So you can just, instead of creating a closure that creates a function value, you can just directly create the function value. So this is what is proposed here. So we have a special purpose code generation that does the code generation for the function value that serves as the closure code for the function value. So what we need to do now in order to translate a complete program is not a lot, actually, because usually you just need to initialize the management registers with meaningful values, like the program counter with zero and everything else just with initial invalid things, and then just start translation of the expression to create the program with. The only thing that you need to make sure of is that the expression to translate actually doesn't have any free variables, because in on the program level you don't have any surrounding bindings anymore. So yeah, these free variables would not be resolvable in that sense. Everything else that you need is then just some way of communicating to the runtime system what the actual return value of your program is, and that is what you usually do with one of these halt instructions. So the code generation for the complete program in that sense would just consist in value object code of the expression that contains the program, followed by a hold thing. So, yeah, with our idea of optimizing the way that code generation works in mind, we might think of the usual suspects like the closure generation and the function generation, and remember that there's kind of a lot of these schemes that produce small chunks of code that are actually used to be pointed to later on from closure objects and function objects, and are placed right in the middle of the actual expression evaluation of, well, the code that generates these function values and all. And in each of these cases, we had the need for a jump to the end of the of this code fraction that was used for implementation of the closures and the function bodies. So this you could see as kind of a spaghetti code that is produced on assembly level. And yeah, well, you could think of well, there's no real need for the code to stay there, apart from that there's you somehow need to access the starting address there. Otherwise, it doesn't make use of any distances to other codes or anything else. So this is just completely non-related to everything that surrounds it. So you could also just pull these codes out and instead have the generating code fall through to whatever comes behind the closure code or the function code, and don't need any jumps anymore. And put the codes for the functions and the closures just in a special purpose place that would collect all these closures and functions. And that would be a thing that you would have to hand through all your code generation functions, being something like a code dump where you could just append those closures and functions to the end. Or alternatively, you could just run an optimization phase after you have produced all your code with your regular code generation schemes, and optimize by just pulling out all these parts and putting them to the end, and then remove the jump and label constructions. And as an example for this thing over here, where we have kind of a lot of these, there's closures in there, there's a function in there, and is there a closure? Let me see. No. There's no closure, but at least there's a function in there. For this one, you would have to generate code in the address A for make function, but instead of putting it right here and having a jump to the end of everything, we just place this code for A at the very end and directly continue after this make function value with mark B and everything else here. So, yeah, that is one way of getting rid of a lot of indirection in code and having more, well, just sequential code is usually a lot more friendly to machine optimization than having a lot of jumps throughout the program. Okay. So much maybe on the low-hanging fruits of optimizations. There's still one that lingers around that we'll talk about a little bit later on. But what I also promised you is that there's potential for extension of the core language to some more advanced concepts of using functional programming. There's the concept of structured data, for example, which is quite useful. So let's have a look what that consists in. So one quite useful thing is, for example, the tuples. You usually construct a tuple by just grouping a few values together. So you usually find these brackets and separate values with some kind of comma. With that, you get for k values, you get a k array tuple. At some point, you want to access whatever you have packed together as a tuple again. For that, you have kind of a destructor operator that projects just if you put this hash j, then you just project the jth component of a tuple. And you can also kind of bind just names to all of the components of a tuple. So the elements that are added to the language then are, first of all, the construction of a tuple value, then the projection of a component out of a tuple value, and then there's the deconstruction, binding names to each of the components of this thing. And in real languages, you usually also have this underscore thing to just circumvent having to come up with names for things you don't use anymore. But this is just an extension of what we see here. So, constructing tuples. This such a tuple thing, being a sequence of just basic values, already might remind people here of things that we have already done before with vectors for global variables, for the global pointer containing all the global variables. So we might even have already a little bit of facilities that we can make use of for creating tuples. So why don't we just do that? And indeed, we have the instruction make vector that will just take basic values from the stack and collect them in one reference. And well, this is quite directly what we do for translating the construction of such a tuple. So the value object of such a tuple construction just consists of, creating the codes for all of the components and then packing them into a reference and storing that away on the heap. So in that sense, just a reuse of a pattern that we have already used for closures and functions. So in that sense, we have just constructed a tuple of all the free variables of an expression, and then continued, just giving one reference to the closure in that sense. So yeah, see it as you may. The other thing would be the projection of a particular element from a tuple. So for this one here, we would somehow have to obtain a reference to a tuple on the pushdown that we can do with some kind of code for a value object of whatever the tuple's expression had been. And then we need to somehow access the structure on the heap and retrieve whatever we are interested with. And for that, we introduce something new, I guess. So this is get j thing, and then do an eval on that in order to really get a value instead of just a closure thing. So yeah, for the get j, you can probably already guess how to do something like that. So it's just a reference to a vector of objects, and what the getJ has to do is it just has to count J many cells in the vector and take the reference to that thing and put it on top of the pushdown. So this works if the top of the stack is, of course, a vector and has as many cells as that can serve the actual index. So yeah, these are the two error messages that are possible there. So we introduce new runtime errors that can happen here. Apart from that, it's just a straightforward run through the components of the vector. Yeah, then there's just the deconstruction part missing. So that is what happened this particular fellow here. So with that, we would deconstruct the tuple from E1 and bind names to each of the components of the tuple. And this can then be achieved how? Well, thinking back to the function bodies where we had to deal with unpacking vectors of already bound parameters and putting them back at the pushdown. We search a little bit and find that there is some kind of quite useful instruction already there, which is this getvec_k that would unpack the reference to the code thing and put it on onto the stack again. So we may have to make sure that the reference to one of these tuple vectors is found on top of the stack. Then unpack it on the stack, and then continue with the actual execution or evaluation of the expression E0 from the let expression. And the only thing that we now have to make sure is that we have cluttered the pushdown with a lot of components from this E1 thing, is that we have to make sure that the result from the actual expression evaluation is sliding down throughout all the intermediately unpacked values of the tuple and resides then at the top of the stack instead of whatever the unpacking of the tuple has given us. And apart from that, all we have to do is to make sure, of course, that during the evaluation of E0, the resolution of the names that we have bound to the components of the tuple are resolved in the correct way. And well, since they are placed just one after the other on the pushdown, we can just use a counter variable I to just count through all of the generated values and then bind them to the according names. Yeah, so this is the getvec. No, finding it here makes me now doubt that the getvec has already been used during the tarc thing. I don't know. Hadn't been there. Okay, so maybe that was just wrongly wired in my brain. Yeah, anyway, it's not an overly complicated thing. It's just retrieving all the elements from the vector that is given on top of the pushdown on the pushdown itself. And this can just be done, just with a simple for loop. And yeah, that's that. Okay, so apart from tuples, what else can we find useful as structured data carriers? And this would be, for example, lists. This is a pretty central part of structured programming in functional programs. So possible constructors for values of type list is usually, well, the terminating thing with which we just have the empty list. So this would be like this nil value, and then there's the concatenation thing that will just take an element and append it to the list. So this will construct a list out of an already existing thing. And the access to the components, then we, in this case, realize via match expressions. So an append function would look like a function that has an already existing list L and a new element Y that would have to be appended to that thing. And this can be done, well, how? In case that the empty list is there, then we would just return Y. And in case that we have a list that is already existing, what we would do is we would prepend the original head to whatever the append of Y to the tail of the list would give us. So with that, we could append Y at the end instead of at the beginning for the whole thing. So this is how match expression can be used in our sense. So in order to support that, we would have to extend the syntax of our language by a few things. There's the constructor for the empty list, then there's the constructor that prepends some element, and then there's the match expression like this. And in order to cope with lists now, we introduce new kinds of heap objects. These are this L fellows here, and if the L just carries our specially encoded nil thing, then this would be just the empty list. And then there's the case where we have a piece of the chain that is not empty, then this would be an L with constructor here as the marker, and this would have two components for the header and the tail, and they can point to other things. So this is in that sense encoding something like a linked list concept. So there's a lot of linked list elements in memory then. In order to build lists, let's have a look at the coding translation functions. So we introduce new instructions nil and cons on the low-level side that are there to create the values that we need. And we can then just use them in our code generation schemes. So for the empty list, we will just directly create a nil value. We don't need any parameters for that. We can just do it with one instruction. And for the other part, well, what would we have expected? E2 needs to be created, E1 needs to be created, so we need code generation for both of those, and then just place the constructor for lists as an instruction around there. So what do they do? The nil will just create a new nil element out of the void. The cons will just take two elements from the pushdown, so both refer to some element in the heap, and the list constructor will create a new list constructor element that points to both of these in its parameters, and it points to the first of them, the lower one of them in its first component. This has been the one that we have created here first, because this is lower than the E2 on the stack, and in that sense we will have the header in there and the tail in there. Okay, now how do we deconstruct that again? This is done with this matching expression. So what do we need for that in that sense? We need to evaluate whatever is in there and check, first of all, of course, if it is an L object, and then if it is an L object, if it is either a constructor or a an empty list nil, and then just jump to the according expressions E1 and E2, and well, in the case of E2, also bind the names for the header part and the tail part. So let's have a look in into that. The first step is the expression on which to actually match. So for this, we need to evaluate by creating the code V part, code V code generation, and yeah, with that on top of the stack, we need to somehow check for something being a list and what type of list. So this is a thing that we haven't dealt with before. So for that, we need a new thing, which is this list tlist A, which carries the reference to some address with it, which is jumped to whenever we find that this is a constructor. And whenever we find that this is not a constructor, then we will just go to E1 to directly fall through to the code generation for E1, and then jump after everything else with this jump B thing. And yeah, well, what you shouldn't overlook is that, of course, we still need to somehow access the head and tail parts, and for that we just need to bind these things via this row prime, which is constructed out of the old row, together with pointers for head and tail in stack distance plus 1 and stack distance plus 2. Okay, so the tlist then, what does that do in case of a nil object? This will just consume the current top of stack and continue with the expression evaluation for the empty list, which comes behind that, but this is not listed directly here. And then there's the case for tlist finding a constructor, and in that case, then what we have to do is we have to make sure that head and tail are accessible on the pushdown, so we have to move them or create references to those two things on top of the pushdown while removing the old reference to the cons element. So we remove that and instead put those things on the push down again, and that is then already all that we have to do. And with that, we can then just find that this is the code. Well, this is quite lengthy in that sense. Are there any direct? Oh, it's also disentangled, so it's moved all the things to the back. How nice. There's the T. So at least there is this T list A, which then does. We don't have the app here, so I don't. It's a little bit pointless to look into that. So you can, I think, if you just review the slides, you can just check how this comes to be. So this is a nice exercise, I would say. Yeah, so what remains now is to fit that together with the parts that we had before. So that would be closures. So we have talked about closures for basic values, for variables, and for function values. But now we have, of course, a few more advanced data types like tuples and lists, and for each of them, well, you might wonder whether it's really a good idea to create closures again, since for the other more basic values we didn't. And turns out, well, again, it's a better idea to directly create the value objects instead of the closures for these types of things, because you would just do a redundant generation of global vector code generation again. So for our purposes, if we have tuple constructors, we could directly just create this tuple instead of creating closure code for that. So we will delegate directly to the value code. If you have to generate a closure for the nil value, well, yeah, this is just consisting in one instruction. There's just no doubt that this is the better idea to do. And even for the application of the constructor, well, this is still just a three instruction thing instead of an eight instruction thing or so. So we will also just create direct value object instead of closure object code for that. So that's just kind of going the same way as for all the other more basic value things that we have seen before. So, yeah, I think that is a thing that I want to keep for next time, so that we still have a meaningful lesson next time. So let's terminate it here, I think.